Crime Curious is a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look into real cases through the lens of a trained investigator and former prosecutor turned judge.
If you are sensitive to expletives, anatomical descriptions, and accurate descriptions of crime scenes, this podcast may not be suitable for you.
Someone you love been a victim of a crime that's still unsolved? Crime Curious has teamed up with one of the top private investigation services in the Indiana and surrounding area. If you have listened to us long enough, you know that we do not seek out services or products that are meaningless to us or hold no real value. So you can trust us when we say that Corbett Investigations comes with decades of experience you won't find anyplace else. Corbett Investigations is run by a former homicide commander of one of the country's most successful homicide units, has put over 400 people in prison for homicide, handled over 1,100 death investigations, and solved 33 cold case murders. To be real with you, Mr. Corbett had a really difficult time telling us what we should highlight in this segment because he does not like to sound like he's bragging. Solving crimes has been his life's passion, and he has never done it for the accolades or recognition. He has a whole team behind his services that help him be so successful, as they specialize in things like bloodstain analysis, ballistics, crime scene reconstruction, and forensic pathology, just to name a few. When you contact Corbett Investigations, you talk directly with Tim Corbett. He is hands-on with every case and can travel anywhere that's needed to get the job done. Corbett Investigations prides itself on honesty, truth, feet to the ground, real investigation work, and the strength to stand up to whatever is in the way of solving the crime. Corbett Investigations specializes in complex homicide cases, sex offenses, and criminal investigations that are old and new. Tim and his team have a reputation for finding witnesses and information that others could not. Although we hope none of our listeners ever need private investigation services, if you do, we recommend contacting Corbett Investigations and mention this segment on Crime Curious for a free consultation. Contact Tim Corbett today at 574-229-8115. You can also check them out on Facebook at Corbett Investigative Services, Inc. or their email, tim@tcorbett.org. That's tim@tcorbett.org. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show.
Welcome to Crime Curious. I'm Charnel.
And I'm Megan.
Let's shake our green, Megan.
Oh, I was using mine as a phone rest. I have two. That.
You do. All right. That's out of the way. If you're not a Patreon, you should join because we just did a Brain Bath Only episode with Brain Bath Jason.
That's right.
It was good.
We always have a good time.
We do. He just left the studio, and now we're on to other recordings.
Business as usual.
Business. What would that be?
BAU.
BAU. The BAU.
I don't know where your
business
mind.
As usual.
Your mind just went someplace weird.
It did. It really did. Okay, so I have a case for you today that if you're a fan of 48 Hours and things like that, you've probably heard about it a long time ago.
I watch it every once in a while. Dateline. Yeah. I'm more of a Dateline than a 48 Hours, but yeah.
And I think, and maybe some, like, you have to be true.
I watched the first 48, though.
Oh, I did not
at
watch
night.
It.
Yeah, I fell asleep watching it.
Oh my gosh,
it's me. It's a person. We'll be okay.
This case, I think that there are going to be plenty who have heard of it before. It is the case of Marty Tankleff, T-A-N-K-L-E-F-F, Tankleff.
Tankleff.
Okay. And we're gonna just go to how this all started here, September 7th, 1988. It was actually Martin's first day of his senior year. He wakes up, of course, first day of your senior year, you're so excited.
You're
right?
Geeked. You might not have senioritis yet, but you're waiting
you're
for
ready.
It to sink in.
Yep. And he starts, he wakes up, the house is really quiet, and he starts calling out for his parents, and he doesn't get a response. So he soon discovers the body of his 62-year-old father, Seymour, and his 53-year-old mother, Arlene, lying unconscious in a pool of their own blood. Now, at first glance, it's very apparent that someone had brutally attacked both of his parents. He calls 911 immediately. Unfortunately, it is too late for his mother. She was deceased and she was pronounced dead at the scene. But his father, Seymour, actually still had a bit of a heartbeat. And Marty performed CPR on him as best he could with instructions over the phone until ambulance arrived. His father was in a comatose state.
Okay.
And he was taken to the hospital.
Were they the only three that lived in the home?
Yes. They were the only three in the home. And when investigators come, they determined that there's no signs of forced entry. There's nothing missing from the home. These two were just brutally attacked and then left.
Did Marty become a suspect?
He was the first and only suspect.
Correct.
Yeah. Later, an autopsy revealed that both of his parents were stabbed before the actual bludgeoning happened. Okay, so his mother was bludgeoned, you know, immediately to death, whereas his father is in this comatose state in the hospital, which he would remain for 2 weeks before he passed away. His father never regained consciousness, and it's very important that everyone remembers that as we go through this. The autopsy showed that there was an obvious heavy object that was used for the bludgeoning. And because of the fact that there was no sign of forced entry and nothing seemed to be stolen, of course, Martin, or Marty as he goes by, is the primary suspect. And they take him down to the station without any explanation. Now, this is his first day of his senior year. He is a teenager, okay? When questioned, Martin mentioned that his father co-owned a bagel store and his business partner owed him about $500,000. And this is 1988, $500,000. That would be, I would have to think, don't quote me because I didn't actually put this into the converter, but we're thinking this is, you know, has to be close to over $1 million.
Agreed.
Today's.
Real close to $1 million.
Yeah. And Martin also explained that his business partner had previously threatened his parents and was in their house the night before the murder because Mr. Seymour, his dad, had a poker tournament at the house.
Is that why he owed him the $500,000? You suck at poker.
I don't know if it was business practices, combination of business practices and poker. I'm not sure.
It almost seems wholesome in the 80s. Dad has poker night. They entertain.
Yes. Yep. And they did. And not only was this business partner one of the last to leave the night before the murders, but they had an altercation over this money.
Yeah. And you showed up at my house to play poker, but you owe me $500,000, fucker. Be responsible.
Right. The police have that information, but it does not matter because of the fact that there's no forced entry. We're going to find that there is some really lazy police work. There's some really suspicious police work in this case. We're going to get to all of that, but and also just some terrible police practices that happened. At the time of these murders, the Suffolk County Law Enforcement Agency was under investigation for corruption that included problems with coerced confessions the time. And they were actually under investigation by the State Investigation Commission, or otherwise called SIC.
So immediately turn it over to a different department.
Oh, no, they
immediately give it to the state.
Mm-mm, no. So Marty is interrogated, and this is a strong, he's a teenager, remember, guys. It is a strong interrogation, and it goes on for hours. And not only that, but the police lie to him. They fake a phone call and say his father had regained consciousness and identified him as the murderer.
You're allowed to lie.
Well, but his father had never regained consciousness.
I know. I'm just saying, people may not like it. It gives you a bad feeling, but law enforcement is allowed to lie about those things.
Well, and something that you should know about Marty is that he had been brought up to trust the police and to trust the word of his father. So when the detectives faked that phone call and they lied to Marty, saying he had come to, he'd identified you as the murderer, Marty started to wonder, at the suggestion of the officers,
if he did it in his sleep.
Yes. if he had been, if he had blacked out and not remembered, if he had been sleepwalking, or even if he had been possessed. We even go to possession. They lead him into all of these possibilities. This 18-year-old kid. Okay.
Well, and I just want to point out too, even though we don't like it, 18 is a legal adult, so you don't have to have a parent there. You read them their rights, but he's 18 and he trusts the police. Well, so.
And the word of his father. And they have told him that his father came to and identified him as the attacker.
And oh my God, if my dad said I did that, maybe I did.
Right.
But he's clearly not. Oh God, I don't love this.
Oh no, you're going to hate this whole thing. Okay. Just so you know. They also told him that it was impossible for him to have slept through that entire thing because it was such a violent attack. How could you have slept through all of that? Only then did the detective read Marty his Miranda rights and draft a confession, which was never signed by Marty. And as Marty was reading through it, he immediately recanted and was like, no.
That didn't happen.
That did not happen. He was responding to the leading questions of the officers about, could you have blacked out? Could you have been possessed? Could you have been sleepwalking? You know, all of those things. And they took it.
I could have done all of those things, but I don't remember doing any of them.
Right. And they took it as his confession. Now, remember, it was never signed and it was immediately disputed by Marty. Okay. His dad did pass away 2 weeks later, like I said, without ever regaining consciousness. So something that you should know, even today with DNA testing, having proven that a quarter of wrongful convictions were based on false confessions, whereas like later on DNA testing completely exonerates the person who ended up confessing and who has said that was a false confession the whole time. Even intelligent and educated people have a difficult time accepting the counterintuitive proposition that someone would confess to a murder that they didn't commit. And in 1990, despite there was an entire wait, by the way, before Marty's trial, and despite not having one shred of physical evidence linking Marty to the crime, they don't have weapons, they don't have fingerprints other than what his fingerprints were in the home, of course.
Well, he lived there.
In his home, right? They don't have, you know, knives, murder weapons, anything like that. The way that the prosecutor presented it to the jury, he was convicted solely on his confession that was enough to get him a 50-year sentence.
Okay.
50 years to life is what the sentence actually would be.
There's a lot of case law now regarding confessions alone without alternative, without other proofs.
Absolutely.
Especially forced or coerced confessions. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that there would have been a ton of motions about whether or not that confession was even going to come in. But I don't know time frame wise if that could have occurred.
Right, right.
It should bother everybody that there was never a murder weapon found. And we should have found some type of a stabbing implement and also some type of a heavy object for the blunt force trauma to the heads.
No, he was convicted solely on the fact that there was no forced entry. There was nothing stolen. And from his confession where he's saying it's possible he blacked out, it's possible he was possessed, it's possible he doesn't remember.
Did they even investigate other people that were there the night before? Was he their sole interest? So
he was. There was never, ever any pursuance of this other information about the business partner. And I'm purposely not including that person's name because there have been no other convictions in these two beautiful people's murders. Okay. So I'm excluding names on these things because this is just one hypothesis, one alternative that the police never considered.
Right. But fact finding and investigating alternative hypotheses that could also fit are really essential to good police work and to good police detectives. And we know those people.
Yeah.
To intentionally not interview every person that was at the party the night before to find out information and let's talk about like who was upset with who and what did you see and how about what state was Marty in? They would have had contact with the 18-year-old if they were there playing poker at some point. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just to say, oh, he never left his bedroom. He was right in his room the whole time. But
none of that investigative work was done.
Yeah. So to not have explored that, in my opinion, is incredibly negligent. Mm-hmm.
Well, remember, the Suffolk County is already under investigation from SICK for corruption. It's 1988 for corruption that included the coerced confessions. Okay. They're just lazy police work. We don't want to go down any other rabbit trails. We think we know exactly. It's this punk kid, right? So at the time of his sentencing, the 50 years to life would have made him eligible for parole in 2040.
Okay.
As soon as Seymour died, which was like 2 weeks later, the business partner faked his own death.
What?
Mm-hmm. And so this is the police at the time, their response to why they didn't go down the business partner's trail, because
he died.
He was thought to have been dead. That doesn't stop you from still needing to do your job and go down. It doesn't matter if the person has died. If they're the one that did it, you find the evidence that of who truly did this.
How did he fake his own death?
I'm just going to. I think I get to that in a little while.
Okay.
I didn't get a ton of information on that.
Yeah, but that's suspicion in and of itself.
Well, agreed. At the time, they didn't know it was fake.
Right.
But they thought he was dead.
So if they think he's dead, they should immediately be like, holy shit. Why are
both of these owners of this bagel company dying?
And we have the son in custody for dad, so clearly
he... it wasn't him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These police officers never watched a crime movie.
No, not in 1988. The only one that was out was Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, but that was good police work.
It was.
A little running on the gray, but good police work.
Right. Marty's best friend from high school, Mark Howard, always believed that Marty was innocent. And obviously this happening on the first day of their senior year left a mark on his soul. It actually helped guide him into studying law, and he dedicated his life after there was a period of like 10 years where Howard and Mr. Howard, Mark and Marty hadn't had conversations with each other. But after he graduated from law school, in 2003, Mark Howard was a political science professor at Georgetown University, and he actually wrote Marty a letter and eventually offered to be his legal advocate for him, okay? And so something that Marty said about this was, when you hear from somebody who you grew up with and have known your whole life, it's touching. But when it's also somebody on the outside who believes in you and wants to help, it means everything. Mark Howard visited Marty at several prison locations as he helped him build a legal case for reversing his conviction.
And this was a classmate?
Mm-hmm. Yep, like high school classmate.
I have goosebumps, and now this sounds very familiar to me.
Oh, okay.
I think I've seen something about this.
Well, and I think we've even covered some cases where high school classmates have become so guided in, you know, to help, knowing that's not, I know my friend didn't do this.
And, or the more you learn while you're in your legal career, while you're in law school, right, the more you realize it resonates with me that I know a kid that was in this situation.
Yep.
He was my buddy.
Right. Mark Howard actually prepared an amicus brief detailing evidence of his innocence, and he confirmed and had it signed by 66 of their high school classmates.
I love that.
Isn't that just amazing? With the support of all of the relatives, including brothers and sisters of both his mom and his dad, okay, he's got his whole family behind him. He has a community behind him, and with a devoted team of lawyers and investigators, privately contracted investigators, they actually did this pro bono for Marty. Okay,
oh, of course.
While he spent his time in prison, Marty himself worked really, really hard to regain his freedom, going through law books. I mean, as we've heard several times, even the people that are guilty as the day is long,
becomes a jailhouse mm-hmm. lawyer for a bit when they need to, unless they can get some help.
In 2001, Marty convinced a retired New York City homicide detective to conduct a reinvestigation into the case. And all the leads led back to the business partner, whose son, as it turns out, sold cocaine out of the bagel stores.
Oh, those were really everything bagels.
Mm-hmm. They were. They really were. The son's enforcer had bragged over the years about having participated in the murders. Through the drug enforcer's arrest records, the investigator found an accomplice who admitted to having been the getaway driver on the night of the murders. So this private investigator in 2001 reopens this case and starts going down information that the detectives at the time did not do. Based on the getaway driver's affidavit and other corroborating new evidence, Marty's lawyers filed a motion for a new trial, which led to months of evidentiary hearings in the Suffolk County courtroom. As a result, the media coverage and further investigation by Marty's defense team, many new witnesses came forward. I mean, it's resurfacing in the media, right?
Came forward. They never got talked to begin with.
They did not. By the end of the hearing, over two dozen witnesses would present overwhelming evidence of Marty's innocence and others' guilt. So the Suffolk County, and you're really not going to like this, the Suffolk County DA refused to recuse himself from the hearing.
It's the same DA?
Mm-hmm. Despite extreme conflicts of interest. And let me tell you what those are. 5 years before the Tankliff murders, this DA had represented the business partner's son for selling cocaine out of the bagel store. During the sick hearings that I was telling you about, the investigative hearings, he represented the detective who would go on to take Marty's confession. And his longtime partner had presented the business or had represented the business partner himself. Okay.
In small towns, you often will have interconnectedness with cases and crimes as a defense attorney. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that the defense attorneys that I work with are very meticulous and ethical in coming to me and saying, I just realized I can't actually represent this person because I represented, you know, the business partner's son. Mm-hmm. And I think there would be a conflict.
Or I represented the
police officer who we're going to.
Who took his confession.
Yes.
And that's what he was convicted on.
Yes.
Or I also represented the business partner who was never considered a suspect.
I just don't see. It's hard because I know this type of corruptness or even just lack of ethics exists. But knowing the humans that I work with, it's just so hard to see a prosecuting attorney or a DA that I know not come to me and say, hey, I probably shouldn't do this case.
Yeah. They could.
It's
just
so easy just to
find someone else. Yeah,
I do it all the time.
Else. Yes.
If there's the appearance of impropriety that may potentially risk somebody's freedom mm-hmm. and their life here mm-hmm. or inadvertently hurt a victim, even yeah. I'm willing to remove myself.
Right. Among the new evidence revealed at the hearing was eyewitness testimony that the business partner had been well acquainted with the lead detective since before these murders. This contradicted the trial testimony of the detective who had been off duty on the morning of the murders but arrived 19 minutes after the early morning call and who ignored the business partner as a suspect. So that never came out in the original hearing that the detective who took this confession had relationship with yep. this business partner.
And they probably called him in when he was off duty or he heard about it and went in on his own because in a small jurisdiction, yep. he might that have happens. Been the only detective or yep. one of two.
Yep. Throughout the hearing, the DA used every tactic at his disposal, including including witness intimidation to discredit the new evidence and protect the conviction. The Suffolk County judge presiding over the hearing ruled in favor of the DA on every motion and on St. Patrick's Day of 2006 denied Marty's motion for a new trial. Let's talk about the appeal.
Please.
Marty appealed his case to the appellate division of the Supreme Court of the state of New York in Brooklyn in a sign of the extraordinary support that the case had received. Several high-profile organizations and individuals submitted amicus briefs, including 31 former prosecutors.
Wow.
Barry Sheck from the Innocence Project.
Yes.
The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and more. Millions around the world had seen Marty's story on 48 Hours and other shows. Thousands of outraged citizens from Suffolk County, New York State, across the United States, and as far away as Australia have visited a website that was called Marty Tankliff. It's still up, martytankliff.org, to voice their support and sign a petition calling on the governor and attorney general to appoint a special prosecutor.
Amicus briefs, both ways are correct, they mean friend of. And so
even if you don't know the person, I know very intelligent law professors from when I was in school. So you'd have like Harvard University. They might write an amicus brief with a certain of their law professors writing in support of something like this. It could be any university. I know professors that did it. And then, of course, the legal and advocacy organizations that you mentioned, who some of their sole jobs are to write amicus briefs mm-hmm. in cases to give a legal opinion. Mm-hmm. And so it is incredible the diversity of the people writing an amicus brief in this case, because you have prosecution and defense organizations writing these.
Yeah. Yes. Judges, law professors, yes. 31 of them, as a matter of correct. Fact. That to me is a large amount, right? Do you feel like that's...
It is a large amount. And again, if all of them are advocating for the same thing, and they may not even be saying this person's innocent, but they may be saying this was not the appropriate way to do this.
Yes.
My legal expertise would indicate that this is a case that should be re-explored.
Yes. And then, that's exactly what it was saying. Okay. That's what they're asking for. Yes, it's just a new trial with this new evidence to really be able to come out and be looked at.
And new evidence is very specifically one the main thing that you need to yes. have a case sent back.
Yep, yep. So indeed, every impartial observer who had reviewed Marty's case, including the retired judges, law professors, investigative journalists, and court officers, agreed that he deserves this new trial. So on December 21st, 2007... So that was, when did I say that it was denied? St. Patrick's Day of 2006, his motion for a new trial was denied. And then, of course, he appealed and submitted all of those briefs. Well, December 21st, 2007, the appellate court, second department, vacated Marty's conviction and ordered his case back to Suffolk County for a retrial to be conducted with all convenient speed.
Which means as quickly as possible.
Yes, yes. So that was December 21st, 2007. All right. On December 28th, 2007, the New York Times broke the news that the New York State Investigation Commission, so SIC, had begun an official investigation into Suffolk law enforcement's handling of this specific case. They were under investigation, remember, in 1988 right. at the time that this case happened, but also now they're launching an investigation for this case specifically.
How terrible that it couldn't have been discovered when the investigation was occurring and they couldn't have said, we're stopping this investigation. It will be sent to a different department until yep. we can get figured out what in the back-ass-word,
yeah, yeah.
the hell ass is backward. Going on here in this yes. department.
Yes. Now, interestingly enough, though, so when the New York Times broke that news on December 28th, 2007, what was really happening was that SIC investigation had been happening for an entire year prior after his first motion was denied for retrial. But, of course, it was kept quiet so that nothing was interfering with the investigation, which is the right process, you know, to follow.
Yeah, until they have their findings that there's inappropriateness occurring at that level. And then anything that was investigated during that time frame really may need to be re-explored in court.
Yep, yep. And so that investigation does reveal that there had been all kinds of corruption, that his confession had 100% been coerced, should not, and considering that that was what was used to as the only evidence to convict him, he is released from prison. He's
probably on some type of bond pending a new trial, would be my guess.
He was exonerated completely.
They didn't recharge him.
They did not.
Well, then that was the appropriate process, and thank God he wasn't recharged, because I was worried for a minute when you indicated the prosecution's involvement that they may be like, oh, well, we're charging him again. Nope,
they did not recharge him.
They couldn't that time.
Nope. And in happy news, so a couple of happy news is here. Wednesday, January 8th, 2014, he's released after 17 years, you guys. He wow. served 17 years for the murder of his parents. Remember, not only is he a teenager at the time of his conviction and going through the stress of a trial and being convicted, he lost his parents.
Yeah.
Like, there's a whole mourning period.
He loves his mom and dad.
Yes.
And he doesn't know what happened to them either.
No, exactly. And he didn't do this, but he's being blamed for it. Can you imagine what he went through? And he was, in my opinion, probably never properly able to grieve the loss of his parents. So this is why I like this little tidbit of information. Because on January 8th, 2014, after he sued, he received, for in a wrongful conviction lawsuit, he received $3.375 million from the state.
All right.
For that. And he also, that was just for the state, but he was going to the federal level as well. And he said, I look forward to my federal trial where I hope to expose the misconduct that caused my wrongful conviction so that it doesn't happen to anybody else. And that trial, I have it in here, he ended up being awarded $10 million in that trial on October 30th, 2017.
Okay.
As soon as he was released from prison, 3 weeks later, he went to law school. He joined law school.
Great.
He got a bachelor's degree in sociology from Hofstra University in 2009, because he was released in 2007. What did I say? 17 years? So from 1990 to, so 2007.
Mm-hmm. And he probably finished high school in prison, mm-hmm. because that would be typical. Sometimes you can start college classes too, but he didn't.
Three weeks after his release, he started and he got his bachelor's degree, and then he received his doctoral in criminal law. And over the years, he now has been associated with various innocence projects. He practices law pro bono with his childhood friend, Mark Howard, who had such a big part of being his pro bono legal team to help fight for justice for him.
Like, I know this was wrong, man. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting in law school and I'm thinking to myself, that is how it's supposed to be. And that is not what happened to my friend.
Mm-hmm. Together, the childhood friends now work for free with other wrongfully convicted individuals through a college course at Georgetown University, which teaches undergraduates how to reinvestigate potentially wrongful conviction cases, produce documentaries of their findings, and create social media campaigns calling for exonerations. Since 2018, their students have helped overturn the convictions of 7 innocent people. This work has given him a purpose in life, and he says that he feels that what his work is now doing is freeing the innocent people. But what I like about this is he isn't just doing law pro bono. He is teaching the next generation of lawyers and how to do it correctly, how to look at the information and the, why am I blanking on the word right now? Thank you. Can you ever see a word in your mind's eye, but it won't come out of your mouth?
I signed my name so many times to documents the other day that my name looked like it was spelled wrong and I didn't recognize it anymore. So yes, I understand.
It's just like all of a sudden I could see it, but I couldn't say it. But yeah, examine all of the evidence, get the proper, you know, the proper way, and how to then picture these red flags, like spot the red flags in cases where people are saying they've been wrongfully, convicted from coerced confessions and things like that. How do you examine this? I just love that they're not just like, you know, feet to the ground helping people. They're also just, they're training new lawyers.
I do love that. And I think that we've come a long way in law schools in terms of some types of practical application where you're actually involved in clinics and such. And Innocence Project as clinics occur at a number of law schools nationwide. But one of the things that's interesting, and I don't know how many people know this, but when you're in law school, for the most part, most law schools, you're really getting the philosophy and the theories, and you don't really take practical application courses with the exception of basic income taxation. And yes, that is as exciting as I explained it, as it sounded. But you're doing taxes and such and working with numbers, as you know, I love from a legal perspective. Anyway, I digress. There isn't really a course that was offered in terms of, you know, legal defenses or innocence projects. So they're coming in and speaking at the very least every either criminal procedure or criminal law class. I think it would be very beneficial to have a defense perspective on these.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we do dissect cases and make holdings, explain what the holding was and why this person was convicted. And maybe if they weren't convicted, explain why as well, because you know you're missing some elements. But this takes it to a new level. And I really love it. I do. Yeah. I think for anybody going into some type of the criminal realm should take some type of a class like that. Me as a prosecutor who comes in, you know, heavily advocating for the state, but only I disclose everything. You know, I gave all the information. I truly only wanted to convict people who were guilty.
Yeah.
I don't want to convict an innocent person of something or have a jury convict them of something based off evidence I'm presenting.
Yeah.
This would be a very valuable class for prosecutors to take too.
It made me wonder, and I didn't find this. And just so you guys know, there are books about Marty's case. Marty still keeps his MartyTankleff.org website up to date. There's blog, you know, information. He has a blog on there and things like that. And it's really just informative of there's all the documents, like the legal documents, the briefs that really helped get him exonerated on there for study and things like that. What I didn't find that I was curious about was how this detective who coerced this confession from him was associated with this business partner. You know, was he in on cocaine deals? Was he in? How dirty, maybe, you know, really was he? I didn't find that how specific they, information, but
how did
that
they find that the business partner was alive?
Just that because he resurfaced. He ran away to California.
Mm-hmm. And faked but his own death somehow, or at least his own disappearance.
Yes, but he wasn't charged. No one has been charged for these murders.
I see that.
Yeah.
But why isn't this man sitting in jail for faking your own death? Clearly there's insurance fraud.
Possibly.
It is very illegal to fake your own death.
To be fair, I didn't go down that part of the investigation because...
Well, you just know he's not in jail.
Yeah, because for me, I know he was a prime suspect, or should have been a prime suspect in this case, and
there
he wasn't.
Is no statute of limitations on murder.
But I did not actually look up the nuances of how he was then found, and he very well could have been prosecuted for faking his own death. I just didn't care to give...
Clearly was never charged with the homicide, though.
No. And that's the part that infuriates
me. Well, we don't know.
No one else was, you know, I shouldn't say, we don't know. Here's the problem.
We don't know evidence.
Right. It was not explored.
There is no evidence. They convicted one man on a tainted confession, and there's no other evidence with which to charge someone.
Well, and part of what got Marty exonerated was there were signed affidavits from other people. And I do think that because of his legal mind and background and the publicity around this case and whatnot, the things that he's been very careful of not releasing names of people who signed those affidavits saying I was the getaway driver or, you know, things like that. I don't know if they were already incarcerated for other things. I'm not sure.
No, getaway driver could have been and should have been charged, but I'll just make that statement loosely, knowing nothing else about the case.
There was a book on his case called A Criminal Injustice. It was by Richard Firstman and Jay Selpeter. And it was released in 2008. He was also on an unaired portion of Dr. Phil, actually. The detective was. It did not ever air.
Really?
There was a lot of speculation. This is actually on Marty's website, but it says, quote, according to the New York Times and Newsday, during a taping of the show, Meeting Dr. Phil, McCready, Detective James McCready, was asked if it was true that Joey Guns Creedon paid him $100,000 to keep the investigation from focusing on Joey Guns Creedon, as alleged by Creedon's son. The book includes a portion of a telephone interview that led detectives in the original case, K. James McCready, from a 2006 episode of the Dr. Phil show that never aired. In it, McCready was asked whether it was true that Joseph Creedon, who witnessed the claim, had hired and paid, you know, $100,000 for his silence. No, that's not true, Detective McCready replied. According to the book, and if it were true, that means he lost money. I mean, he only got paid $50,000 to do the murder.
Wow.
So there's just a lot of back and forth, but like I said, nothing has been explored in court, and so that's why I don't like to talk about it,
especially with you on the
podcast.
Not now.
Yeah, yep. And so we can read about more about the investigation in the book if you would like to. or even just get on Marty Tankleff, T-A-N-K-L-E-F-F .org to explore it a little bit further if you'd like to. I'm purposely, you know, being a little vague here because of your position. And so, but I wanted that story to be told because I agree with the statements that there's a lot of very intelligent, very educated people who just don't believe in coerced confessions and how they can happen.
Oh, they can.
And they do. And I don't know if it takes people being in the experience of like law enforcement and in us or
watch
whatever.
A video of one.
Yeah. I mean, you can watch Making a Murderer documentary on Netflix. That shows you a lot. Even if you don't know anything about investigative practices, I think you could understand more about how leading questions can lead one to answer things that makes it sound like a confession. Or even there's just people that blatantly write and sign a confession. Like it's just... it does happen. And then, and we know this because later DNA evidence has exonerated people who have signed false confessions before.
Correct.
And immediately regretted it. I mean, that's the other thing. They always recant, but the recantation are never taken seriously.
Right. It doesn't pass on motion.
Mm-mm.
You know, I want this excluded. I don't want this admitted at the trial because it was a forced, coerced confession. And then the judge is like, well, if you did, you were freely, you were free to leave. You were, you know, your name is signed on there. You clearly acknowledged it then. What's different now? You know, and they say it's coming in. I'm letting it in.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's a wrong decision by the judge either, based off the information that they have at the time. But a jury hearing that confession, man, they go a long way.
Well, and take into account the state that Marty would have been in. He was interrogated for hours the same day that he found his parents bludgeoned to death. The trauma, the shock. He worked on trying to save his father's life, you know, calling 911 immediately. And then we're not talking days. We are talking the same day he is interrogated for hours. The state, the emotional state that he must have been in. And then to have been told, your dad regained consciousness, so there's a glimmer of hope.
And he says you killed him.
Yeah.
You killed your mom. You attacked him.
But then you still have that glimmer of hope that he's going to make it, you know, because he was in a comatose state for 2 weeks. It's just, all of it is just so... oh, it's so sickening to me to think of this poor kid, because he was still a kid. You know, he was 19 when he was convicted a year later to 50. You know, here you go. You're going to spend the rest of your life. And he knows he didn't do it. Then the trauma of whatever he experienced being in the type of prison that he was in, of course, was for
murderers,
highly dangerous people. Right.
And he's a high school kid.
Exactly. He's a 19-year-old kid. How awful. So, yeah. So I just wanted to bring it to the attention because I do think that more understanding needs to happen around how
this
coerced confessions can happen. And because it does seem like, God, why would you ever admit to something that you didn't do when there's people out there that won't admit to everything that they have done?
I think in his case, though, clearly, just so we can point out, he never ended up signing the confession.
He didn't. And he was immediately saying this is not true. Once they wrote it up for him, he would not sign it. And he's like, no, this is not true.
I can hear it now. They're asked, could this have happened? Sure. Could that have happened? I mean, I guess. I don't really remember. I don't know what's going on. He's thinking his parents are dead the whole time. Then they get it all written up and he says, no, sign this. And he says, no,
that's not what happened.
It never should have made it.
No,
it never should have made it in.
Mm-mm. Nope. And to just not have anybody else, just because there was no signs of forced entry and nothing else stolen from
it
the house.
It makes you a suspect, but it doesn't make you guilty.
It doesn't. And also I think when people are brutally murdered in that manner, there's not going to be stuff missing from the house. When people break in it was clearly not a robbery, right?
No.
Like, give me a break. So the fact that nothing is stolen means, to me, as an investigator, means nothing. That's not why they were in this house, obviously.
The fact that there should clearly have been other persons of interest because there are other individuals that wanted to cause harm to the family, like a person who owes you $500,000.
That you were fighting with the night before.
Just, God damn it. This whole case.
That, right?
You're going to have to bathe me because I'm getting angry.
I'm
now.
Going to, and I'm bathing you with instead of a funny story, I'm bringing you another warm bath We are going, this is just a good-hearted,
just a little
wholesome story.
Bath.
You're going to like it. I'm going to first show you this picture of this poor little squirrel whose teeth and gums had grown too big.
Oh, my okay? God. Oh, God.
I know.
That poor this animal.
Poor baby. And this is from the Washington Explorer. And the title is, A Rancher Finds a Squirrel with Crooked Teeth and Gums That Are Too Big, and She Brings the Animal Home to Save Its Life.
You guys, this tooth has grown all the way back over this animal's shoulder.
Yep. Yep. It is all the way across his back, face. Yeah. Yep. You may think that squirrels are adorable and fluffy creatures that scamper around your outside.
That is a squirrel of nightmares.
Yeah. However, they may be, in reality, tons greater than that. They're intelligent, social, and adaptable animals that can live to tell the tale of almost any surroundings. Their fascinating dental machine permits them to gnaw on nuts, seeds, and bark without carrying down their teeth. But what happens when a squirrel's tooth develops too lengthy and curly, making it impossible for him to consume or even get food near his mouth? That's the catch-22 situation that this blogger faced when she discovered a terrible little man under her. She had like a bird feeder. It was suffering and it was trying to nibble on some seeds under her bird feeder.
Starving to death. Mm-hmm.
His enamel was so overgrown that it curled and returned into his mouth, inflicting pain. She said she knew she had to do something, so she determined to take him home and provide him with a dental makeover. So she actually went onto YouTube and learned how to clip the incisor teeth of a squirrel from YouTube.
It's like a rodent. If people have issues with their rodents, like their rabbits and stuff like that, and they can go have them clipped their teeth.
And this is what I loved. She said, when I approached him, he did not run away like the others. He just sat there looking at me with big blue eyes. I saw that he was in trouble. His teeth were so long and crooked that they prevented him from closing his mouth. He was like two teeth and with horns. I feel sorry for her or him because I guess it was a her. I feel sorry for her because I knew she couldn't eat her usual diet and she must be suffering. So she said, I gently picked her up and wrapped her in a towel. And this is what bothers me. This article keeps going back and forth from he and she.
Okay.
So I don't know if the squirrel was a he or
I
she,
I don't think
guys.
Anybody did a sex check on the squirrel. No. They were more concerned with its teeth.
Because it keeps saying he didn't. I gently picked her up and wrapped her in a towel. He didn't resist or touch me.
Okay. He, she, it.
Yeah.
They, there.
Yep. The squirrel trusted and appreciated the help. So she actually took him into a cage with water and soft food, named him Bucky. And then she got to work. He or she just let her
like file cut. Down?
Yeah, she actually cut the four incisors on the top, like the top two and the top lower, and was able to say, I want to show you the after picture because you can see where how the teeth had curled back over its face and it had imprinted in its fur. And so once she, look at how cute he is, once she took him off, but you can still see those imprints from the teeth
pressed
on his face.
Pressed into his fur on the low right side of his cheeker.
Yes. Isn't he so
Did
cute?
Did she cut his teeth all the way off or are they just hidden by his lips?
No, just, hidden by his lips. She cut him down enough so that he can eat.
Well, rodents like that, they're constantly growing, those teeth are. People don't realize it. So they must be chewing, gnawing all the time.
Yep. So I don't know what happened to this one. Maybe it got sick and it couldn't eat the stuff that would ordinarily grind down and keep the incisors at the right size. But Bucky is doing wonderful now, has stayed in her yard. Here's a picture of him healthy.
Oh, just Bucky, looks like a normal, you're so cute. Looks like a normal, big, fat, normal gray squirrel.
Yep. And so she feels like this animal was not scared of her and it possibly was just too weak to even fight her anyway because he was so malnourished.
Yeah.
But the fact that he has stayed around and he still doesn't run away from her.
He needed help.
Yes.
He knew benign face, a benign human.
Like I'm
benevolent human.
Isn't that just such a sweet story?
It is sweet and wholesome. Thank you. That is a real brain bath.
It is.
Thank you for bathing me.
I like it. Nice and clean. So thank you all so much for listening and supporting our podcast. If you would like to get hundreds more episodes, feel free to click the link in our show notes to join our Patreon. You can also join from our website, crimecuriouspodcast.com. And we're there pouring content into our Patreons every week as well. So
about 10 times total a month.
Something like that. So yeah, thank you so much. And until next time, we hope that you keep it curious.
And keep listening, y'all.
Bye-bye.